Welcome to Wrap'em Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. At Wrap'em, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started.
So many of us went into medicine because it is always changing, providing a career steeped in learning and creativity. Perioperative medicine is no exception. How to optimize patient outcomes in the perioperative period is a hot topic and one Wrap'em loves to support. Today, we're going to be talking about the perioperative use of hallucinogens. Hallucinogen use in the general population is growing, becoming more and more common, with an estimated lifetime prevalence rate of approximately 9%. What is particularly interesting is the renewed interest in the therapeutic benefits of drugs commonly classified as hallucinogens. Such new applications may dramatically increase the chance that these drugs will be coming to an operating room near you. Today, we are joined by Dr. Trent Emmerich. Dr. Emmerich is currently an associate professor in the departments of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine and bioengineering at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and School of Medicine. He is a fellowship director for the Chronic Pain Fellowship and associate chief and the medical director of the UPMC Chronic Pain Division. He is also the designated pain specialist for the NFL Pittsburgh Steelers. And I think we should probably do a whole special session just on that. So Trent, thanks so much for joining us. Trent is the first author in a narrative review examining perioperative issues related to these drugs. After reading your paper, Trent, I realized that, you know, terminology is really important here. These drugs are kind of complicated. And I understand that hallucinogens are kind of a parent category and everything is really a subcategory under that, such as the psychedelics we're going to talk about. So if you don't mind just, you know, kind of start things off, can you summarize the framework to describe these drugs so we're all speaking the same language?
Yeah, of course. And now that we are getting started, Brian, I couldn't thank you enough and want to thank you for talking to me and allowing us to do this. And I should also right off the bat thank the co-authors, Doug Reary and Jeff Martin out of Wake Forest and Tanya Marshall as well out of UPMC that put a lot of effort into this over the last couple of years. It's been something fun and interesting to kind of write up and discuss more too. One other point I was just thinking too, I don't know if you had seen or anyone had seen in the news, but Roland Griffiths, kind of a renaissance man in the field of hallucinogens and psychedelics, just passed away a couple days ago. So I saw some media attention on this just in the lay press about what he really has done over the last couple of decades at Hopkins, to kind of bring psychedelics for something that was kind of off to the side, and kind of brought more credibility to it through all the work that he's done through the university. And so it's very timely. I was just thinking that we're talking about this when there is all this attention with Roland Griffiths passing away a couple days ago, too. That's a great first question, Brian. Hallucinogens can refer to different things. And you hear it kind of described a lot. And so it is something that's probably relevant to define, too. Hallucinogens, kind of in a broad sense, I just think of it as something that alters the sensorium. Anything that alters the sensorium, there may be visual changes, there may be audio changes. But in general, it's something that alters the sensorium. So in many cases, like when people think of hallucinogens, in many cases, they're actually talking about the classic psychedelics. Those are the molecules and the substances that actually are gaining a lot of media attention, and states are maybe trying to look at changing the laws, or there are certain pockets of the countries that are decriminalizing. And those are things like the magic mushrooms, the psilocybin, which is the active ingredient, which are the tryptamines. There's other plants derivatives. And we'll talk a lot more about that, I'm guessing. But there's other things that are hallucinogens, other categories that are hallucinogens as well, that are outside of the classic psychedelics. And kind of what defines the classic psychedelics is most of these are mediated by serotonin 2A receptors. And that's what's so profound about these classic psychedelics is they have specificity for the 5-HT2A receptor. Whereas, you know, if you take an SSRI, the serotonin increase is going to affect a lot of different receptors, like the 1B receptor, and not necessarily the specificity that the 2A receptor. And that's what kind of makes these classic psychedelics so unique. There's a lot of other categories, right? There's ketamine and PCP, which are the dissociative anesthetics that definitely have some hallucinogenic potential with the right doses. And they might not have the same hallucinogenic potential as the classic psychedelics, but at the right dose, they can and they do. And as anesthesiologists, oftentimes we're very familiar with these. There's the deliriant class. Again, they may not be classically associated as a hallucinogen, but scopolamine and the antimuscarinic certainly have the potential to cause hallucinations at the right doses. And I also think, even though this next category, like MDMA, isn't classically considered a hallucinogen, MDMA does have hallucinogenic potential. What's unique about that is it's kind of in its own category that's like half stimulants and half hallucinogen. And that category has been given this name, the entactogens or the empathogens. And whereas the most of the stimulants that are out there are dopaminergic agonists, MDMA has this potential to excite and be an agonist at both the serotonergic receptors and the dopaminergic receptors. So it's one of those hybrid molecules. It's not really a classic stimulant. It's not really a classic hallucinogen. And so it's kind of halfway between. But basically the category of empathogens, it gives the user the ability to really have introspective look upon their own life and have a very unique sense of self and self-worth that is unique to a lot of other substances out there. So I know, sorry, Brian, that was kind of a long-winded way to describe some of the...
I think it's a great framework, and I refer all of our listeners and readers to go to the actual manuscript because there's a nice summary table. It's hard to do it, you know, in a simple way via audio, but I think that's a good framework. And what I'm always interested to hear from authors is how they actually got interested in the topic that they got their paper published on. And for you, this is a somewhat controversial area with respect to obviously the medicinal applications, and you're trained in chronic pain and anesthesiology. Where did your path kind of intersect with these medicines, and how did you get inspired?
About 7 or 8 years ago, I realized my inpatient chronic pain service, my consult list, was almost as much of addiction medicine or substance use disorder than it was chronic pain. And so as it is still now, that there's that open period where you can apply if you see enough chronic or addiction medicine in your practice, apply for addiction board certification. And so that was kind of my entry point into learning more about substance use disorders through some of my mentors now and colleagues and friends like Lynn Cohan and Ajay Wasson. It's kind of helped expand my horizon and worked on various projects and papers around substance use disorders like buprenorphine. And over time, that's kind of morphed into learning about other substance use disorders. And we published, my group has also published some on stimulant use in the perioperative period. And there's such a crossover between stimulant use and hallucinogen use that turned into another area of interest for me too. But this is something that I do encounter. I've seen interesting combinations of patients on hallucinogens presenting post-surgically or post-operatively with complications related to hallucinogen use. And so maybe my original use, original interest kind of came out of getting certified in addiction medicine, but it's kind of blossomed in this very fertile area that I like so much because so much of it is unknown and new to the anesthesiologist as well, too.
So do you think that your interest was more about how to manage patients who are illicitly using, or maybe that's not the right term, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but are using it not under the supervision of, let's say, a specialist, but and they may be treating themselves medically, I guess, or were you more interested kind of in like initiating therapy for the right indications or what you perceive to be evidence-based medicine?
I would say the former. I think just feeling underprepared to treat the patient intraoperatively, postoperatively, who has been exposed to hallucinogens or what have you, or psychostimulants, was my initial interest. And you're absolutely right. Like, almost all of these hallucinogens and psychedelics are still considered Category 1 substances by the DEA. Now, you know, especially like Roland Griffiths, like I mentioned, some of the work that he's done and some of the other groups that I'm not doing, but other groups are doing with breakthrough. Some of these substances do have some breakthrough status that are being studied in limited amounts at different universities around the country. And so they are actively being studied outside, you know, in a very legal setting. But my personal interest was being able to help these patients who may have a use disorder, a hallucinogen use disorder that presents and are sometimes very tricky to manage, even though they may not be the world's most complicated medical challenge. But if you're not thinking about it and you're not aware that these substances are out there and probably more prevalent than we realize, it may throw, you know, something pretty simple to treat into, you know, a medical conundrum that lasts days in the hospital in the postoperative period. No.
Right. And actually, that's one of the reasons why, and this is a good point for the listeners, that was actually something that got our interest in your paper in particular, was the clinical applications to the perioperative arena, because this will make us better physicians and better be able to care for patients in a more cost-effective way. And you mentioned in your review that the dominant effect of the hallucinogenic drugs, you know, is basically an altered perception of time and space or a dissociation from the environment and is perceived physiological stimuli. Now, I think we can all understand why such an effect would be used illicitly by some people, but I personally struggled with, and I'd love to get your insight on this, how this kind of these effects would actually be helpful in a medicinal sense or in a medicinal application.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I think there's that fine line between, you know, in the psychedelic literature and even on the side, you hear a lot about microdosing, heroic dosing, and finding there's always this balance to try to find the correct dosing that may relieve or may have the user feel like it relieves some stress or depression or escape from reality that's beneficial without necessarily getting to the point of psychosis or extreme anxiety or extreme paranoia. But oftentimes it does cross over. And the problem is some of the designer molecules that are now becoming more and more popular, like the NBOME category of the phenylethylamines, basically the same category as mescaline. There's these designer molecules that have a narrower therapeutic window, and you're much more likely to cross over to that violent behavior or aggressive behavior and not have the classic, you know, hallucinogenic sense like LSD, you know, people think of. I think people are going after that perceived sensorium where they have not necessarily an addictive component to it because they're not really seen as addictive, but they're entering a altered sensorium that's pleasurable and tolerable and offers them some escape from reality too.
Escape from reality. Let's say in the setting of like chronic pain, is that a potential area to consider because yeah, I think you mentioned this before. On your service, you had a lot of people with addiction problems, and that were supposedly you're treating for chronic pain. And then it's this chicken and egg story, and you don't know which one is actually making which one worse. And perhaps maybe like a treatment with a drug we know ketamine infusions are popular now, and even some clinics for these reasons. But I assume the idea would be to kind of give the system a break from the trauma, the stress.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, what holds such a great promise with this category. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, this category of medicines, like what happens over the next 5 or 10 years with these breakthrough status medicines. Like the single doses of psilocybin, which is converted to the active form psilocin, or two doses in two separate trips or journeys, in some of these early studies or early results, for things like depression, refractory PTSD, cancer-related pain, cancer-related, you know, coping with cancer diagnoses. Single doses have profound effects that seem to linger and last for months and months and months or more than a year, which is just profound to think of in the psychiatry world. So few medicines have any kind of impact, let alone, you know, in our pain world too. We just don't see those kind of effects from single doses. But the thought of these medicines, what's so interesting and in a way cool about them is that they can provide neuronal plasticity and allow an introspection that happens during these sessions, these therapeutic sessions, that can focus, you know, the patient away from maybe a new cancer diagnosis and more towards something more positive. And I think we're going to be encountering more patients in that situation. And we've already seen, like, I definitely want to give credit, like Tim Furnish and his group at UCSD, and they published an RAPM in the past about the role of hallucinogens and specifically for chronic pain. But I think there's a growing need to understand the role of hallucinogens just in the perioperative period.
Yeah, and that's actually a great segue into my next question, because I kind of see different scenarios in the perioperative arena. You know, there's the obvious one where someone comes in acutely intoxicated, and we have new kind of recommendations that were published in RAPM about cannabinoids in this situation. And there's a recommendation to actually cancel the case. And so I assume if someone comes in acutely intoxicated, I hope that's the right term, then you would probably recommend canceling an elective.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. And our impression as the authors is that, our recommendations almost mirror the, cannabis recommendations. All patients should really be asked about hallucinogens, given how prevalent it really is, and it's only increasing. It's very easy to add on, you know, any recent cannabis use or hallucinogen use. And it may be negative, and they may say no in the majority of cases, but the risk to the perioperative period, whether it be for serotonin syndrome or hemodynamic changes, which usually are mild, but the concern for postoperative withdrawal or postoperative changes or postoperative serotonin syndrome are certainly real. And it's certainly a very easy thing to ask too, especially because of the serotonin syndrome risk. That alone, like all the number of anesthetics that we use to propagate serotonin, it just seems like a no-brainer that we should be at least considering this too.
Yeah, so I assume then if it's an emergency surgery, you proceed, obviously, because you have to do that. And then what would be your thoughts on like steps to take to, let's say, deal with that serotonin syndrome, higher risk, or other potential negative implications of the hallucinogens?
So the initial things are all supportive, right? Fluid management becomes essential. Some of the psychedelics in, you know, even within the main categories can cause rhabdo and kidney issues. So fluid status is important. You can see hyperthermia. So temperature regulation is considered important. And then there's also the concern of what to do with psychosis or paranoia. Benzodiazepines such as diazepam are excellent in a first line treatment for this. Haldol is considered significantly is considered a safe and significant option to use. So a lot of it is supportive. Obviously, avoiding you know, the methadones, the fentanyls, the Demerols, the ondansetrons, the medications that propagate serotonin makes sense. And then the other things we might not think of, like low stress environments or low stimuli environments in the postoperative period with, you know, patients in PACU, simple things when someone is still acutely intoxicated, because the half-life may be 4 to 6 hours, and then maybe, you know, a couple half-lives while they're still experiencing symptoms. They need to be in a PACU bay that's isolated, quiet, that has continuous monitoring. And so I think it's actually a lot of basics, but things that we may not think about, especially something, Brian, that we hadn't necessarily talked about, especially because it's hard to detect hallucinogens in urine drug screens, and the patient might not readily admit to it. So unless you're thinking about it and directly asking them, you may miss it because a UTOX might not pick it up too.
No, that's really great advice. And I learned my job because I learned stuff like this all the time that I wouldn't have known. If someone's using the drugs chronically, let's say recreationally, or I guess it doesn't really even matter if it's medicinally, Like what would be the specific concerns that may be a little bit different than the acute intoxication? I assume there's overlapping concerns, but is there something, like you had mentioned withdrawal before, and I know that ketamine withdrawal is real. I've actually seen that before on a patient that we got consulted on for acute on chronic pain on the APS service, and they were taking actually like ketamine as an outpatient. I believe it was I actually don't remember the what are the routes. Actually, you could probably tell me what are the routes available for ketamine as an outpatient. Is it the nasal spray or is it
right? Yeah, the intranasal S-ketamine. That's becoming more and more popular for psychiatric and refractory to treat depression too.
Yeah, and this was for PTSD kind of treatment. But anyway, she withdrew because we didn't have intranasal ketamine, and the hospital medicine service didn't like kind of recognize it, and then we got called. And we realized that was when we put on a ketamine infusion, which was the easy fix. But what about some of these other drugs in terms of their chronic use and concerns surgically, perioperatively?
There's less studied on the specifics for chronic use, or you just don't see the studies that look at chronic psychedelic use or chronic MDMA use. I will say for MDMA. MDMA, we know like acute intoxication, that's amphetamine. So acute intoxication is going to raise the MAC. There's more ambiguity for chronic amphetamine use, like MDMA use. It may lower the MAC or it may keep it the same, and it's hard to predict. But for a lot of these molecules and substances, you have to worry about catecholamine depletion. You have to worry about, the sympathetic response is generated, depleting catecholamines. You have to worry about and think about avoiding some of the indirect sympathomimetics like ephedrine and using more direct sympathomimetics. If you also have to worry about, say the patient is chronically on something that's very stimulating and they're depleting their catecholamines, using ketamine for induction might not be the best idea either, because they may be catecholamine depletes and you're going to see some of the cardiac myodepressant effects of something like ketamine. So
yeah, good point. Yeah. So this is, it's almost like you need like a formal consult if this is identified with someone like you. And I was just thinking when you were talking about some of these drugs, it was really like a foreign language to me, because these aren't drugs that, that we're used to even knowing anything about. And this has occurred to me. And I was wondering if you have a recommendation about, like, if I'm in the pre-op clinic and I figure someone's using some of these medicines, is there like a quick website that I could like access, or maybe everyone's just doing ChatGPT now, but where I could actually type in the drug, A, learn how to pronounce it, because I think I'd struggle with that, and then B, learn about some of the mechanisms and maybe perioperative considerations, because I'm worried that there's so many of these drugs, and like I wouldn't be able to do that in real time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, that's a good question. Like there's a lot of the literature that I see, like it comes from the peer reviewed. Like I can't say I have a great, other than the American Society of Addiction Medicine, some of the information they have on their website, I can't say I've seen any great, quick, high yield, publicly available documents. I think part of the hope, Brian, especially with our article, is it can briefly and succinctly summarize some of the perioperative considerations and some of the basics. But certainly there's quite a few studies that are starting to look at some of the psychiatric implications and the chronic pain implications. But I don't see a lot of high-yield, high-reputation sites that go to. It's really something that's probably needed more. It really is.
Right. And that's a good point. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we support your article, is to get this, get some traction in our community to think about these things in a real resource. It almost seems like you need like an app or something, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. These substances, you're right, they're not in the brain of the typical anesthesiologist that we routinely think of every day. Their mechanisms aren't necessarily entirely foreign. They're a lot mediated by serotonin. But there's all these designer compounds, or you hear the term novel psychoactive substances thrown out a lot with these. Every month there is a new acronym or a new abbreviation for these hallucinogens or psychedelics that are coming out or being used illegally. And so there is a lot to keep up with. And the state regulations are changing. There are certain states and certain cities that have tried to liberalize or decriminalize certain medications. So there almost does need to be a better central repository for this information. Or maybe it exists and I'm not aware of it, but it's not something I've necessarily seen too.
Right. Yeah. And this is, we're at the really the beginning of this whole process. And you had kind of alluded to before, and we started talking a little bit about the ketamine withdrawal. So is it a real thing to withdraw from some of these other drugs?
Not classically with the psychedelics. There's certainly a perceived state of altered consciousness, but you don't really see the classic dependence, tolerance, withdrawal cycle from these. And that does make it maybe easier in the perioperative period. Now, it doesn't apply to all the psychedelics, but a lot of them, especially the ones that are purely mediated by, you know, 5-HT2A or serotonergic mechanisms, they may not have the classic withdrawal. So that at least is maybe one less side effect. Whereas with, you know, with ketamine and maybe some of the other substances, I didn't even mention before at the beginning, in a way, you could almost consider opioids at the right dose a hallucinogenic medication as well.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah.
The classic hallucinogens we think of, you don't have to worry about withdrawal nearly as much, though.
Okay. Oh, that's actually really, really helpful. And I think our readers like will be interested in knowing if acute pain management is implicated in acute pain management, is it more problematic in these patients? Do they are they hyperalgesic, or are they higher risk for pain, let's say, or is it something that you know, that's not really a big deal?
You know, it's interesting. There's some evidence in the pain literature, and like I said, Tim Furnish and his group has published on this before, that the psychedelics may, through their mechanisms, actually inhibit some of the TNF-alpha, tumor necrosis factor alpha, inflammation that occurs. And there may actually be, and I don't know if this has been proven on the acute pain side as much as some of the studies on the chronic pain side, but there may actually be some benefit or therapeutic benefit in the, you know, for acute pain. It would probably be a stretch to say in the perioperative period at this point, but I don't necessarily, and it may actually reverse some of the hyperalgesia or some of the pain that patients would experience, as opposed to inhibit or make it harder to treat too.
Right.
It's a really interesting.
That would make sense too, because if you know, ketamine being a drug that we're very familiar with and we use all the time and to reduce opioid utilization. And on our APS service, we'll run infusions to basically, we call it resetting the receptors, the opioid receptors. I don't know if that's really that, but you really clearly can, if you reduce your opioids, you know, some of that opioid-induced hyperalgesia, you can kind of reverse. And I think that perhaps maybe some of these other drugs might have that benefit too. So yeah, that's really good. And it's, it, this whole topic is so poorly studied. I think you've already said that, and I couldn't agree more. So what do you think are the logistical, like, next steps to better understand these drugs for pain physician, let's say chronic pain physician and perioperative physician? Like if you had the unlimited resources and, you could start, and there were no legal implications, you're emperor of all of the, you know, the research world with endless money, what would you do next?
I would love to. So from a clinical side, I would love to, you know, if it was done under the right ethical umbrella and the right, you know, IRB and everything, to start to look at some of these substances that may have benefit perioperatively. Specifically talking about psychedelic substances or derivatives that may help out specific patient populations like trauma victims, ICU long-term patients, in and out of surgery for burn surgeries. There may be specific populations that psychedelics could benefit and provide both an escape from dread or, you know, the trauma that they're experiencing, but also benefit them perioperatively, whether it's pain relief, you know, without exposing them to additional risks. So I think there might be a limited use. Again, no, I think it probably is a limited use where there is a pure therapeutic perioperative benefit. But I think honestly, more common is we're just going to see more and more patients either using these substances coming in and being exposed to these substances perioperatively. And now we as the anesthesiologist or pain physician have to treat them or manage their postoperative pain.
And that kind of like bimodal interest area is so fascinating. It's how do you deal with what's coming in, and how do you potentially use these things therapeutically to help patients through very difficult situations? Yeah, I'm thinking about some of the consults we get on APS. These people that are, you know, in critical care settings for a long time, have extensive injuries, extensive pain, lots of situational depression, anxiety. And which we fail, I think, a lot to adequately get under control.
Right.
And there's got to be, especially like, you know, if there was a major accident and someone was, let's say, you know, killed in the accident, and you're a survivor,
right?
And
right.
you have pain, and that's a huge cycle too. We see, and I wonder if there's better ways to do things. So, you know, I think you've hit all the kind of key points, and I really encourage our listeners and readers to go to the original manuscript, look at the summary tables, post any questions that you have, and we'll keep the dialogue going. So thanks so much for joining us, and thank you, Trent, and thanks to all of you who listened in. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Rapham Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the Rapham Journal, and you can visit us at www.rapham.org.